We are here on Talking History, doing a live show on Talking History with George Stoney, the famed documentary producer. He's been at it for half of a century, producing and directing documentary films, active in community media. And we left off with discussion of a number of his commissioned works. And we're going to move a little bit forward here because I want to get into a discussion of the documentary form itself and how it's changed over time, and then look in more detail on one of George Stoney's historical documentaries, The Uprising of 1934. So let's move a little forward in your career. You were doing this for decades, working for different companies, including the Borden's Milk.
Yes, that's right.
I was looking at the list of your 50-plus films.
Yeah.
But in 1970, you went into NYU. You started teaching for NYU?
I'd been teaching there some in the summer. But in 1970, I came from the National Film Board of Canada, where I spent 2 years, to take over the undergraduate division of film and television.
And what did your job involve at NYU when you came on? You said you took over the new department?
They just started, 2 years before, they'd started the Tisch School of the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was started with graduate programs in dance and theater and film and so forth. But they had taken on some undergraduate courses that had already been running at NYU for 20-some years. And one of them was a very strong program in undergraduate film training, headed by Haig Banoojian at the time. And that was where Scorsese that was where Oliver Stone and those people, just at 68, 69, 70.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a tension between this new graduate program that was coming in that was kind of claim all the resources, and this undergraduate program that had already made a name for itself that was struggling. And they came to me at the film board to say, would you come down and take this program over, because maybe you can deal with this dispute between the two groups.
And did you?
Well, I got out of it after 2 years. And the dispute is still there to some extent.
And you got out of it and you did what?
When I got there, I found that Haig should have been head of the department. And Haig said, I know I should be, but the dean's afraid of me. And I said, okay, Haig, let me fire the people that should have been fired, and let me make the changes that are going to ruffle a few feathers, but I can get by with it. And then you take over when they get rid of me. And instead of getting rid of me, Red Burns and I started the Alternate Media Center to do something about cable television. And they were then wiping their brows and said, let's get rid of him. Let's go over to Haig. And Haig was mm-hmm. the head of the program for the next 16 years.
So in the alternate media division or department, you were getting involved in video, in other new technologies? And
was 1972, mm-hmm. 71, 72, yeah. When the Porter Pack had just come from Japan, and when the streets were full of people demanding the right to speak, the right to media and so forth. It was all in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hot from the National Film Board of Canada and a program we had there called Challenge for Change, which was designed to help government agencies have dialogue with the people they serve. And so Red, who was a Canadian, and I formed this with some Markle Foundation money, because cable television was just coming in, and Markle said, we want somebody to see what we can pull out of this. And also the National Endowment for the Arts was interested. And so we set it up on that basis, setting up internships. At that time, the satellite hadn't gone up, so the only reason for having cable was for better reception. You know, if you live in a mountainous area, you live in New York City, the only justification was if you were near skyscrapers. So that Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island didn't need cable. It was just Manhattan. And that was the first place where we had cable. And so we set up internships in a number of places around the country with the cooperation of the cable industry, because they were just beginning and wanted to encourage people to subscribe.
Mm-hmm. Well, from this is a theme that you've explored and you will be exploring here during your visit to this area. I'd like to refocus our discussion, though, on the documentary format and the documentary form, and particularly on where you situate yourself in the long history of documentaries, going back to Flaherty and going up to the present to Morris's work on Fog of War, or to Ken Burns. That you wanted to say a few words on Ken Burns. We'll get to that in a minute. But could you do that a lot, situate your work in that context?
Well, let's just talk with Flaherty, okay. Who is regarded as the father of documentary. And when you look at him, he seems like a kind of romantic escapist now. But he did introduce us in Nanook of the North to the advantages of using real people and real situations, though he may have created some of them. And his classic powerful film, Man of Erin, which he made in 1931-32, had always fascinated me. And that was made on an island in the west of Ireland, off the coast of Galway, where my father happened to have been born. So my son and I were cycling across England and Ireland, and I said, let's go over to see where my father was born. And so I got to know the island, and I began to see what effect Flaherty's film had had on the island. It turned into a tourist place. And I met some of the people who had worked with Flaherty and so forth. And at the meantime, at the NYU, I was teaching a course called The Documentary Tradition. And I found students were having trouble understanding the whole theory of documentary. And I thought, this is a good time. Let me make a film that will show how and why Flaherty made the film as he did and what effect it had on the island where he made it. So I made a film called How the Myth Was Made, which, by the way, just has been reissued in a DVD by Home Vision Entertainment, carrying Man of Erin, and then my film. And by the way, if you've seen Man of Erin, most of you who are listening have seen it in the old, big, terrible, scratched old prints. You should see that DVD. All of Flaherty's glorious photography is there, restored. And my film, which can only be seen in old faded prints, they went back to the original, they restored the color, and both of them are grand.
Uh-huh. Now, your film was made in 1978, the original. And
my film was made in 1976.
76.
But it's a comment on Flaherty.
Uh-huh. Now, you were concerned with the impact of film on a community, on people, and that seems to be something that runs through your entire work, that your sensitivity to the audience and the power of the documentary.
Well, you see, if you're dealing with real people, as I often help my students to understand, you're dealing with people's lives with unique faces, and you always leave your mark. In fact, I did an essay at the release of How the Myth Was Made, must the filmmaker always leave his mark on the places and people he films? Inevitably, that process has its effects. And I wanted the students to know that and to feel it, because then it makes you responsible. Actually, I learned that way back in the Southern Educational Film Service. We knew, for example, that the films we made were going to be shown first in the communities where they were made. So we were very careful about the way we presented those people. We wanted to do the truth, but is the truth with people with their hair combed or with their disheveled? With those little things that matter so much. And I learned that. Here's a very crude example of that, and I hope it doesn't shock your viewers. We made a film called The Birth of the Southern Pine for people who are into forestry. And we have a long shot, and the man's cutting down a tree. And then we have a mid shot, and the man's working very hard up down the tree. Then you see the close shot of the axe going in, and you see he's really skilled. Well, that happened to be a black man. Now, if a good film editor knows how to get to get dramatic sensation from this, is that you would cut to the axe going in the tree, you would cut to the long shot to show the context, and then you'd cut up to the close shot of the man making an effort. I knew in that community that that would excite racial responses. Boy, look at that guy sweating. Wonder what he smells like. We cut with our stomachs because we were Southerners. We knew that that would be it. So we said, okay, long shot, man cutting down a tree. It's happening. Close shot of the axe going in. He's really skilled. Back to the long shot, man cutting down. Finally close up. He's working very hard. And just getting over that immediate emotional response. That's the kind of minute example of social responsibility what the filmmaker should have if he's using real people and dealing with real problems.
Fascinating. We don't have a lot of time, and I wanted to get to the film, The Uprising of 1934, because a lot of the points we're talking about, a lot of what we're talking about really can be made. Tell us the history of The Uprising of 1934.
Well, in the first place, it's just not my film. Judith Helfand, all my films are collaborations. And I collaborated with Judith Helfand, a former student who worked with me very hard, and Susan Rostock, who was the editor, and my son, who's the cameraman. So that lots of people worked on that film. There was a failed strike in the South at the textiles, 1934. And it was such a failure that somehow a myth grew up about it that the textile workers shouldn't have stuck their necks out. They did something wrong. And for half a century, that was the myth in the cotton mills. You don't fool with the union because look what happened to you last time. They went off and left you. And in the middle 60s, when they were starting the middle 60s and early 70s, when they were starting the J.P. Stevens strike, attempts to organize J.P. Stevens, a big, big thing in the South, they found that there was such a prejudice against unions all over the South that something should be done about it. And they asked me if I would go and see what could be done. Well, I went down and I came back and said, don't make the film. Why? I said, well, the places have been changed so much. The few people who remember it are ashamed they ever got involved. Even those few who remember with some pride what they did have sick and 80 years old and have lost the fire in their bellies. Don't make the film. They said, wait a minute. So, why did it happen? How did it happen? Maybe we can interpret it. Well, it took us 9 years to find that formula with the help of a lot of historians and a lot of sweat. But I think we did it eventually.
I do too. You start the film off with a discussion of silence, of the silence. Everybody, these are excerpts, a lot of oral histories, or video histories, and everybody's talking about why they don't talk about it, why it's not discussed. It's I don't know how many minutes of the beginning, and then the story begins. How did you get to that structure?
Suzanne Rostock, she's a marvelous editor. And the voiceovers are little bits and pieces from dozens of interviews we did with striker survivors. But it's an antiphonal argument between the owners and the workers, giving their social attitudes.
Mm-hmm. It's really beautifully done. And then the last voice, there's this one, I don't remember the direct quote, but there's one worker who talks about how we should remember it or something. The last thing was the transition to the remembering part of the film, which was lovely, really lovely. And then the story begins. How did you structure? What decisions? How did you work as a group to put that film together?
Again, it was Suzanne Rostock working very carefully with us. But I should also explain that we had a lot of pre-screen rough cuts of just parts of the film. For example, we had owners talking about the stretch out, which was the central argument in the film, was that they were speeding up the machine so hard, so fast, that the workers weren't making enough hours, and they were also getting hurt, and they were terribly tired, and so that was one of the big issues. So I knew I wanted to have the owners talking about that as well. So in the film, at that time, we had three owners talking about it. One was, he said, well, it was a lot of competition. You had to keep up with the others. Another said that it was a matter of the prices and so forth. The third one said, I had a bunch of people standing around, didn't have enough to do. They didn't. Well, when we showed it in the South, there was a kind of, and I thought, gee, they're really responding. I told that to Susan in New York City where she was editing. And she said, George, they're responding to that guy, not to the issue. And we took it, and she took it out. Well, I tell you, it took me three audience tests to prove how right she was. I mean, that's she's a brilliant, brilliant editor.
There's nothing like a good editor. We just have a couple of minutes. I wanted to get this to this one question because we discussed a little earlier that we were going to talk a little bit about Ken Burns. You're involved in your films are often socially engaged films. Ken Burns makes lyrical films. Could you talk about his work versus your work? Yeah.
First, I want to say that Ken Burns is a very fine filmmaker. He's done a lot for documentary, although he didn't invent a lot of the things that people think, that's Ken Burns' development, simply because it's the first time they saw him using the moving camera over stills and so forth. But his scholarship is impeccable. It's the packaging that makes us nostalgic for the Civil War, one of the most brutal wars we've ever had. It's the music. It's the golden glow over battlefields. It's the way the letters are read, the sentimental ways the letters are read. So it's the packaging. And this is exactly what I'm afraid he's going to be doing with his new series, which is about the Second World War, that so-called good war that a lot of us were in, and know that there was just all the terrible kinds of things that we're hearing about happening in Iraq. It happened in the Second World War. We just don't talk about it.
George, I wish we had another hour or two, but we don't. It's time to end this segment of Talking History. Thank you so much for coming and spending a good part of this past hour with us here.
Well, it's fun to be with you.
Well, we're going to have to bring you back. I know that you have family here in this area, so there'll be an excuse to bring you back here and talk more about that.
Thank you.